Let's bring the Senate and House Transportation Committee to order. And from the Senate side, there's Senator Jones and Senator Menard, Representative Foster.
Yeah, we've got Foster here, Phillips, Mackey, and Cabina.
In today's meeting, we're going to have an overview of the international airports and the marine highways. And present there, we have Commissioner Turpin, and we have Mr. Simmons. And what we have on the agenda is we'll start with airports first.
Yes, sir. We would like that. I thought it would be of interest to the group who may not be familiar with how the International Airport Management System was developed and some of the reasons for it, to have Randy Simmons give you a brief overview of that. Then we'll get into some more of the aspects of managing the airports and where we're hopefully headed on that score.
Just hand me a chair.
Bring a chair. No, scoot up here. Come on, we'll get you up here. We'll get another one over here.
Chair right here.
We're going to need another one. Get the other one. Up over the top.
Here, Lauren.
There we go.
That's what I heard. Right
up there. Oh, there is.
Knock anybody out.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if it please, Randy Simmons, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation. What I thought I'd do is just give a brief overview of the airport system itself. For the new members of the legislature, the airport system is comprised of two international airports, Anchorage and Fairbanks. And they are completely funded out of the International Airport Revenue Fund, which is a self-generating fund. No money's come from the general fund to support the airports. All the revenue that goes into the fund itself comes from users. It comes from the airlines, concession agreements. In FY90, to give you an idea of how much revenues went into the fund, it was $55 million. Out of that $55 million, roughly, Anchorage comprises 94% of that, and Fairbanks comprises 6% of that. On the expenditure side, Anchorage has about roughly 75% of the expenditures, and Fairbanks 25% of the expenditures. As most of you have heard over the last few years, there's been a lot of concern about what's happening at three international airports with our revenue picture. A lot of talk about the international airports or the international airlines not flying through Anchorage any longer because of Glasnost and because of 747-400s. What that's done is it's been a tremendous shift in where the revenue is coming from in the last few years. Where we used to get the majority of our revenue from international passenger flights that go through, about 40% of that, that's dropped dramatically. Since 1988, Anchorage alone has lost 54 scheduled weekly flights that fly through. And what that means is that we're not getting the landing fees from the passenger craft that fly through, and it's a real drain from the duty-free shoppers, which was our largest concession. We used to get we got as high as $19 million from duty-free. In this next current year, our projections are that if we make the minimum, which is 12, we'll be lucky. And the reason I say that is that even though we have a minimum of 12, if traffic drops off drastically, which is less, it drops off more than 25% of a base year that we picked in the contract, they can actually pay less than what that minimum was. Our best guesstimate on what's going to happen in next year is that we'll probably be down to 68 flights a week for international transit.
Passengers?
As I mentioned, the real threat in the past had been just the aircraft technology and glasnost. What we're faced with today in the ever-increasing times is, as you've seen, we've had readout blow in Anchorage, which has affected the traffic out of Anchorage. The radical increase in fuel prices because of what's happening in the Middle East, and what that is also doing, not just for the Alaskan airport, but for all airports, is that the amount of travel, international travel, is down dramatically. To give you a couple examples, just to show what it's like, Our latest statistics show that an Air France Concorde from Paris to New York flew last week with only 7 paying passengers on it. JAL landed in Anchorage last week with 19 paying passengers. So you can see that the effects of not only the overflights, but even the flights that are coming through is having a dramatic effect on what's happening with the two airports. You probably ask, what are we going to do about this? What are we doing about it? 2 years ago, with the help of the legislature, actually it was three years ago, we established a marketing program at the international airports. The idea at that time was to focus on two different areas that we saw where we could gain increased revenues. In the short run, what we wanted to do is we wanted to focus on the cargo hubbing. And we've seen with the Federal Express coming in and with UPS coming in into Anchorage, we've been real fortunate. The other part, and the second piece, was to create demand, the demand travel into Alaska with tourists. That's a slow process, and we haven't gotten as far as we'd like to. We're starting out now with our existing funding with the new contracts with both Anchorage and Fairbanks community groups, where we are giving them both $100,000 currently to market the two airports. In this year's request, you're going to see a capital amount of $250,000, where we hope to be able to use that to match the duty-free shoppers' money that they put forward to see what we can do on the demand travel. It doesn't mean that we'll spend that. We'll only spend it if we can show that we have a good potential of attracting the carriers. In the cargo area, where we're trying to go to now, is that now that we have the UPS and the Federal Expresses, we need to create the demand. The next big area that we're looking at in Anchorage International is a cargo warehousing distribution idea. And what you have there is you have someone like a UPS and FedEx who has the capabilities of reaching anywhere in the world, servicing someone like an IBM who establishes a facility where they have a parts bank, basically, and they can get out quickly to anywhere in the world. That's one of the areas that we want to work closely with Anchorage Development Corporation. The second cargo possibility that we're working with the municipality of Anchorage at this time is the sea air cargo link up. That's probably a longer term development. We just recently finished with a consultant study that came out 4 months ago looking at the viability of Alaska being part of that sea air cargo hub. And even though we have some concerns and things that we have to overcome, the viability is there. That's big revenue generation for both LA and Seattle. We're a little bit behind the curve on that. At the present time, one of the big issues at the airport, and I'll let Frank address that, is what we're doing to make sure that the airports stay viable and what we're doing with the management. Actually, I'll just let you jump into that one, Frank.
Thank you, Randy. As you know, or probably know, we have a vacancy now at the Fairbanks Airport, and we're out looking now for a professional manager, someone who has had experience managing airports, who has the proper training and has the will to take on a tough situation and try to reduce the cost of operating the Fairbanks Airport. I think you probably have heard the comparison of Juneau and Fairbanks, and there are differences, certainly differences. Juneau owns their own airport, and it's managed locally. They have a professional manager running the airport. They make a small profit on the airport, maybe $1 million or so a year, and they give excellent service in the Juneau airport. I've been very much impressed with the way it's maintained and the way that everything is provided. Fairbanks Airport, which is essentially the same size in operation. Now, there are some differences, but some differences favor Juneau and some differences favor Fairbanks. But the Fairbanks, with about the same revenue as Juneau, is losing from $4 to $7 million a year. So although we think that we probably can never get the Fairbanks Airport to a profitable situation because of the complexities of some of the things we have to do up there I think we can greatly improve that ratio, and my ideal would be to get them to break even. Now, I don't want to have you misunderstand me in thinking that Fairbanks is worse than Anchorage. I think it just shows up in Fairbanks because it's a smaller operation, and there's a tremendous number of efficiencies and changes that we can make to the Anchorage airport, and we plan to do that as well. So for the time being, we're looking at continuing with essentially the same management system that we've had, having a manager at each location, but still retaining the system to coordinate a lot of the common things about the airport. There's some big advantages for operating as a system. For example, one thing, if I think you're aware, the landing fees at both airports, they operate as a system, so they're the same, is about 82 cents a thousand. That may increase some this year with some of the problems that we're having, but it's somewhere below a dollar, about 82 cents. And I think the largest estimate I've seen has been 90 cents for the 92 year. If Fairbanks had to operate break even with their landing fees, their landing fees would be about $7.50. So they enjoy the lower landing fee as a result of having the system together, which helps attract flights and service to the Fairbanks Airport. Juneau landing fees are a little bit over a dollar.
$1.20.
So you can see that is a good thing for certainly the Fairbanks Airport, and we hope to continue with that. We also, as you know, in the past have had some problems with the public safety aspect of actually both airports. Certainly in Anchorage, we were in the headlines for a while. I'm happy to say that revisions to that are well underway, and we're very alert to the problems. We have turned over the security outside of the terminal buildings to the Anchorage City Police, and we were able to convince them to undertake this at really no additional cost to the airports. This represents about a $700,000 savings right there, and the reason that we were able to do that, we have a lot of taxpayers who are on the property outside of the airport, and they have a right to city police protection, and we were able to convince the city authorities that this really was their responsibility. Well, even above the $700,000 saving, I think it makes a lot more sense to have a police department handling the security in the properties outside of the terminal itself, and we will have a smaller force in the terminal as a result of this. Fairbanks, we're on the search now for a security manager, and we hope to again bring in a professional who has had experience in this and can really contribute to the security of both airports. We're getting a real test now at both airports on security, and outside of a few problems when we started this operation, I think it is going extremely well. We have the complaint level has dropped down to just a small amount. Maybe they're all addressing them to you since the legislature's in session, but I've gotten very few in the last few days from that. A few people have had their cars hauled away. I think we've averaged at first about 140 a week. The word is getting around now, and it's unfortunate we can't let people have that luxury of leaving your car unattended on the ramp while you carry your bags in. But that's something the FAA just doesn't accept these days.
Frank, on that issue there, on the airport security, are those within the airport, is that a contract division or is that under public safety?
No, they're under the airport management, except for the people that check your baggage as you go through. Now, that's something that the carriers provide. That's not the airport services. The security, the true security people belong to the airport. Did I describe that right?
Correct.
Okay. If you see more people than you think are needed checking the bags, that goes to somebody else. It's okay. Not ours.
Representative Don?
Oh, just along that questioning, Mr. Chairman, is there a new contract at the Anchorage International, and is there something like that at Fairbanks now that has some independent security officers there?
I'm sorry, Representative. I don't understand.
We have the airport police.
Yes.
And then I understand there was a security contract that was awarded that they were like independent a private security firm?
I think there's two firms out there that are independent of our airport police. Dynair has, I think, Loomis Security, providing extra security right now because of the situation with the FAA. One of the doors that they're responsible for that gets out on the operations area was left unattended one day, and that's how the Chinese defectors got through that. So they put on extra security. And what we have is, I wouldn't call them full-fledged security people, but we have let a short-term contract to deal with the extra security outside on their, not the rampways, but out on the roadways, informing people that they can't park their cars for within 100 feet, that type of thing.
Yeah, that's a temporary...
All temporary.
Expedient, though.
Okay, so that's... I was wondering if that really is a temporary thing. I was wondering what kind of training they're receiving and how long is the period for that?
The period, well, I'm speaking without full knowledge. The period most likely will be until the FAA security drops from the threat level we're at now to a lower level to where we can back off in security. The training itself... in the process they go through, the procurement process, they set out specifications of what's required, and I can't tell you off the top of my head what that is, what training they have.
Both are bonded.
They're bonded. It'd be like a Loomis security. I think it's something less. I don't believe they're carrying guns, but I don't have that information.
Shouldn't be. They may. I understand every retired policeman in Alaska is employed now, either by the pipeline or the airports. It's been quite a feat to get that much increase in security.
Senator Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have two or three questions, if that's all right.
Go ahead. If it's too long,
not just on security. Okay. Well, the first one is kind of on security. We were talking about the JAL planes that are coming over with just 18 passengers and that sort of thing. Should we attribute any of that to the fact that the long delays caused by the increased security that we had the first few days? Is that filtered back and Japanese are climbing on the nonstop flights instead of coming through? Or is it happening to all their flights?
It's happening to all the flights, and it's happening worldwide at this point. I think the delays you're talking about, what we had, where the first day and a half, the Immigration Naturalization Service would not even let what they required is normally the passengers who are coming through for tech stops, which is getting fuel, they can get off in the international terminal. They don't go through the security measures. They shop at duty-free. They're there about 45 minutes to an hour. They get back on the airplane. What the Immigration Naturalization Service required that first day and a half is they were looking for four known terrorists that were supposedly coming through the United States, and they required this at all the major airports. They made every passenger who was on each of those flights get off the flight, go outside of security, and not only did they just check them in, they basically interrogated them as they came in. We had one KAL flight that missed its curfew in Seoul and had overnight in Anchorage. Delays were up to 6 hours. Because of that, the airlines that were telling us, JAL, that they were not going to fly through Anchorage any longer. In fact, they were looking for other places to go. We were able to work out with the Immigration Naturalization Service to where we beefed up security so they were comfortable. People wouldn't get off the plane and go through security and get out into the U.S. But from all indications, it didn't help us, but it hasn't. That itself hasn't killed us.
So has that three-day visa program that Senator Kasky worked with, so we can have people fly in, stay over for a few days, and then fly on, is that kind of at a standstill for the moment?
I would say so.
Okay. On federal airport funds that come to us, is there, I know we're looking at some changes in the highway funds and the way they're divvied up back in Washington. Are we looking at any changes in our federal airport funds? Should we expect less, more?
At this point in time, with the FAA, the federal funds, we're not looking at something major. What all the states are pushing for, because we have, I can't remember exactly what the billion-dollar level is, but in the highway or in the aviation trust fund, we have a lot of funds that are just accumulating and not being used. We're paying for them. but it's not coming out. So what the states and all the airports are proposing is to try to use that funding up. The biggest thing that is coming out as it relates to the federal government and the aviation side right now is the passenger facility charges, to where they will now, they're proposing that they will allow airports to charge up to $3 a head for a person who uses the airport, gets on a plane, disembarks. We had some of that back in the 70s. If an airport does qualify to do that and does it to use it for capital projects, they're proposing that 50 cents on the dollar of the aviation money that normally would come would not come back to the airport. So what you're basically going to get is 50 cents more on the dollar.
Could you go through quickly with us the status of the operating agreement with the airlines, and then how the mechanics work of the airlines looking at the capital projects that you say you'd like to do, and whether or not they really have veto power?
Okay. The airline operating agreement is basically a contract between the state and the airlines that use the airfields that basically says that all costs of operations and capital projects are paid for by the airlines. That's why no general funds go into that. Basically, what we do is that we prepare a budget, an operating budget, that then comes to the legislature that's approved, that they then fund through the operating agreement. Right now, we are about to start the second five-year term of a new agreement. So 6 years ago, we started with the first airline operating agreement, which is basically common in all major airports to have this type of agreement. Alaska's kind of been blessed with having one of the best agreements in the U.S. because we got in the game a little bit late, so we have things in our agreement that are quite a bit better than some of the other major airports. We just renegotiated a new agreement. The agreements are in the process of being signed right now. As to capital projects and the veto power that the airlines have, there's a provision in there that if we propose a project, say a road project in Anchorage or Fairbanks, and the airlines, they then vote on all of our capital projects, if they don't want that project to go as a part of their rate base, which means that they have to pay for it right away that first year, they have a one-year veto power where they can say, basically, we don't want that one to go forward. It does not mean that the airport can't build that project. We just cannot then charge it back into the rate base that first year after it's completed. If they veto a project, which they have in the past, and we technically don't have to take that project before them the next year, automatically we could fund that project through the airline operating agreement and it goes into the rate base. What we've normally done, because we try to make this a partnership with the airlines, is if they have major problems with projects, like we've had some roadway projects in Anchorage where they have major problems, instead of always going forward for a vote, we just pull it back off and try to figure out exactly how we can meet their concerns and still meet the concerns of the airline. My own personal opinion is that basically it really gets down to, it's a legislative. Legislature can appropriate any money they want for it. If the airlines say they don't want this project, you still have final say-so as to whether it's appropriated or not. So technically, I don't think they really have what we would call a veto power from an appropriation.
Okay. I was thinking in terms of like could, and then changes there, because I foresee that the major, particularly international airlines, and probably our major domestic airlines, aren't going to be real interested in paying the cost for 200 more float plane slips.
We're actually looking at a couple things with Lake Hood at this time, Senator. We're looking at the whole master plan as to what we should do with general aviation around Anchorage International Airport. The FAA has some real concerns, and I think that the airport management has some real concerns about increasing general aviation around the international airport. So they're going to take a look with a new master plan as to what we should do. The old master plan basically had millions of dollars in increases to expand the general aviation around the international airport. The second piece that we're going to look at doing is with the float plane slips on Lake Hood, they pay about one-third of what a fair market value would be if you went outside the airport system. And we're going to be looking at bring that up a little bit.
100%.
That was a, I had a constituent bring that example up when he was leasing some land out on the Tall Shalitna. He said he compared his land, what they were paying in Anchorage at the stuff, and thought he had a pretty good argument.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, good. If we could go ahead and, I know we're going to run a little short on time today because we're having the Senate caucus meeting at 2:30, so if we could, are you close to finishing or having you wrap that up?
Finished.
And then before we go on to the Marine Highway system here? Yes, a couple questions, before we move on here. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate the opportunity to sit in today. I want to do a couple more questions, follow up on the SkyCap situation. What's the present status of that lawsuit now? There's been the motion for summary judgment.
The motion for summary judgment was granted on four issues.
Is it?
The one issue it was not granted on was whether the state would be jointly liable as an employer for a period of time limited to 17 months. And my understanding is, and I haven't seen a letter, is that the SkyCaps are going to propose a compromise to that, but I have not seen anything. For our status at this point in time is we'll proceed to trial.
But isn't that the main substance of the case? I mean, wasn't that the crucial issue about whether or not the state shared liability?
I think it's one of the crucial issues. That's correct.
Yeah. So I mean, the committee should. But what do you think? How much money is at stake there? What's the state's liability?
At this point in time, Representative, I can't answer that because before, if the state would have been held liable, it was for a number of years, 4, 5, 6 years. The court has limited that exposure to 17 months, and I have no idea what that might be.
Okay. Yeah. So at this position, is the department going to engage in any negotiations to settle that case? Or?
We will not initiate any compromise negotiations. If the SkyCaps wish to bring forward a compromise, of course, we'll look at it seriously.
Okay. And why is it that this state is not going to initiate settlement?
Because we feel fairly confident that we're correct legally and the position that we've taken. We have a number of concession agreements out there, hundreds of contractual agreements out there that basically would be put into question as to whether the state's an employer or not an employer on those contracts. We feel that we're not an employer in those situations. It was a concession agreement that we worked that we let. And if there's an employee-employer relationship, it rests with the contractor.
Well, I would, you know, at this point, I'd hope you do pay attention to that situation there, because I do think, it seems to me, the state bears a lot of culpability for what happened there, and keep an open mind on what might be the best public policy course of action there.
We've tried to all along in the process.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps somebody already asked it, Randy, but is the Federal Aviation Act up for reauthorization this year, as is the
I think it's 1 year, next year. It's next year, 1992, I believe, but I'm not, I can check on that.
No, it is.
Okay. 92.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. At this time, we'd like to go into the ferry system. Also, we'd like to note that we have Deputy Commissioner Springer in the crowd here. Throw in anytime you want to give us any advice or anything.
I know nothing about that.
Thank you very much, Ben.
I need to change shifts here. Just
okay, yeah, we're going to.
Mr. Chairman, I have the director of our Alaska Marine Highway System, Jim Ayers, with me, and I've asked Jim to give you a little rundown of the ferry system in general, so you'll, except for Bill Hudson, you can sleep through this, so you'll have a better understanding of what the vessel fleet consists of and what some of the problems are. Jim, you have a few very attractive aids that I think you plan to use.
His aids?
Those kind.
Visual aids. When I saw Henry, I couldn't miss that.
Behave. We did put these together. These are photographs and basic information about your fleet. There are 8 vessels. We have now surplused and sold the MV Chilcat, which some of you may have been familiar with. Otherwise, it has other names, more affectionate names that people on the Metlakatla, Prince of Wales Island have used for the last 10 years. But The fleet is comprised of 8 vessels. We service 32 ports. Last year, and we will finish scanning 1990s tickets this week, but we set new records. This past year, we moved more than 410,000 passengers and a little over 100,000 vehicles. That's an increase of more than 100,000 passengers and 30,000 vehicles since 1985, in the last 5 years. The demand continues to increase. Each of you have been sent, but may not have yet received, this year's annual financial report. And what we have done is put together a financial report that has the basic financial information in it, as well as a review, which is required by the new statute, of the Alaska Marine Highway System Revenue Fund, which is also enclosed in the financial section of the report. One of the things that is clear in here is that the Marine Highway System Fund is working. It's going to allow you to actually identify the amount of general fund revenue that will be required, as opposed to just looking at the total amount of money. You'll be able to see the general fund amount that's required and then what we'll be able to do with that amount of general fund in order to meet the demand. The system plan was something that you have all been interested in and that we talked about last year. I think there was a resolution that directed us to have it completed by last April. In the course of events, the Marine Highway System Department of Transportation got a clear message from the Department of the Federal Highways people of the Federal Department of Transportation telling us that they would look to the system plan to determine what projects they were going to allow us to use federal money on. So we did engage in public hearings regarding the system plan throughout the state. We held some 17 different hearings in 12 different communities across the state, including Kodiak, the Kenai Peninsula, Anchorage, and 7 different sites in Southeast, and we held a hearing in Cordova. The other thing that we talked about last year that several of you were interested in is I did order condition surveys on each of the vessels. Those condition surveys are now completed, and we have good information about what the condition of these vessels are and what it would take to get another 15 to 20 years out of the vessels. It is clear from those condition surveys that we must make some decisions this year regarding either refurbishing those ships or beginning to dispose of at least one of those vessels. And certainly the issue of capital budget and operating funds are interwoven there. If in fact we're not going to operate the vessels and we're not going to make a commitment to refurbish the fleet, this is the year that we should make the decision to begin to downgrade the system. We have developed a 10-year financial plan and a variety of alternatives, which will probably come up under the discussion of finances and finance committees. I won't get into. On the board over here is a look at operating plan by vessel by month and what status they would be in. The top one is the operating plan that is proposed that the communities that addresses the need, which is consistent with kind of the last 2 years of service. The one below that is our currently printed operating plan, which is clearly subject to a discussion of supplemental that will come up in Senate Finance. Be glad to answer questions or to go into more detail about any of those items or anything else you've recently heard about the Marine Highway System. We have made some changes.
Well, we heard you had an accident. Why don't you bring us up to date on that?
Start
on the negative, then we'll move on to positive.
The motor vessel Matanuska, which is one of the 3 major mainline vessels, was proceeding to the dock in Bellingham. In Bellingham, for those of you who have not been there, it moves to load and unload, moving astern, going backwards. She loads through the aft doors. As she was proceeding to the dock, running in reverse or astern, there was a mechanical malfunction that caused them to lose control of the starboard engine the master had gone out to the port wing to take control, and there was lost control of the starboard engine. The ship was then continuing towards the shore and went around our dock, and basically there was mechanical malfunction by the time they got the engine shut down, and he had proceeded back to the wheelhouse, and they got the control down in the engine room that the dock was the ship was into the fishing dock, which is just south or southwest of our dock in Bellingham. It was clear that he was making the right maneuvers, and the Coast Guard has not issued a final report, and so I'd like not to give you any information that may be misinformation. I'd like to wait until we get the final Coast Guard report to give you the final on that. There's one passenger hurt. The captain was out to visit her today. I was down there over the weekend and met with risk management people and our attorneys, and met with the port as well as the representatives of the customers who had gotten representation. And it's my opinion that we've resolved the major issues at this point. We have the Matanuska tied at the Wistock. We unloaded the passengers and took the Matanuska over to the Wistock. We then loaded the we moved the Malaspina into the dock. Within 12 hours, we had all passengers. We were back on sail, and all passengers were then loaded on the Malaspina and proceeded north. The Matanuska is currently docked, as I say, at the Wist dock, and we're negotiating with MIC in Bellingham, which is a shipyard there, for an emergency purchase to immediately get the ship back into operable condition, and we're waiting on an estimate of the cost of that at this time.
And so, we're making adjustments to the services with the rest of the fleet, and how is that going to be affected? Is this going to be
currently? We do not operate, generally speaking, we don't operate at least one of the major vessels in the wintertime. And so the Malaspina was sitting at the dock in Bellingham. She was in layup status. We simply activated her, got the ship ready to sail, and moved her to the dock, moved the Matanuska over. We intend to get the Matanuska back into sailing condition in the next 15 to 25 days and put her back on the run and put the Malaspina then into her annual overhaul, so that then hopefully they'll all be ready to roll the 1st of May.
Representative Hudson?
Yes. Jim, is there any underwater damage, or is it primarily just structural to the aft loading ramps?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hudson, we had an underwater diver, if that's not redundant. I suppose they're skydivers, but we had a diver go down and do what is called a thorough, and we're satisfied that there is no underwater damage to the props. The primary damage is to the car doors, the pneumatics that operate the car doors, and there is some question, and we're waiting on ABS and the Coast Guard to give us an opinion about where we drove the car doors. Were driven by not only the pilings in the dock as she went into the dock, but there was a crane on the dock that came through the car doors onto the deck and moved cars and car doors and the crane into the stanchion. And so we're waiting for an estimate on what they think about both the stanchion and the steel plating on the upper deck.
Structural for safekeeping.
Yes.
Representative Phillips?
I have a question on the system plan when we're done with the accident.
Okay. Any other questions on the accident?
Well, one thing we might add, which was perhaps a little more dramatic, but when the ship was in reverse, the chief mate was on his way down to supervise the unloading on the car deck and immediately realized the danger to all of the people who were beginning to drift down and get into their cars. We're not sure how many were in their cars. We know that there were at least 30, and there may have been as many as 50 or 75 already down on the car deck, partially in their cars. Chief mate ran down, grabbed the bullhorn, and in a very persuasive manner, got everybody out of their cars and over into safety, into the passageways, except for one lady who went back to pick something up out of her car. And she then tried to return, but she was, I think, about 15 cars from the stern of the ship when it hit, and it jammed her between two of the cars, and that's the lady with the broken leg and the broken pelvis. Now, without the quick action on the part of the chief mate, we would have probably had fatalities as well as some very serious injuries. As a result of his actions, we had only the one injury on the entire ship. We have roughly 12 to 14 cars that were totally destroyed, and perhaps as many more that suffered heavy damage. So you can see what a tremendous impact that ship took.
Senator Pierce.
Hey, are we on time?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Menard. Excuse my ignorance, but are our four mainline ships large enough that they require pilots on board in any waters, even
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, the answer is yes. In certain waters, we are required to have a pilot on board on those mainline vessels, yes.
Was there a pilot on board in
yes.
the docking?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Mackey.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Harris, just one question in regard to policy. I can appreciate what the commissioner had to say about the quick action of the crew. Is it a policy that passengers are not allowed on the car deck until the vessel is secured, or is that only on the smaller vessels?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mackey, without getting into a discussion that may lead us into temptation here of speculation, I'll answer the question by saying that it is a prudent person rule. And I believe that we act prudently, and we were acting prudently. I am in the process of reviewing that policy, and we'll be meeting with the Coast Guard this week. And I discussed that item with several people while I was in Bellingham. It was one of the other reasons I went, including talking with our attorneys in the Coast Guard about that. It's a prudent person rule. There's not a regulation. We intend to establish a policy. And I have issued a temporary policy that says that passengers will not go to the car deck except when the ship is at the face of the dock, or when she is en route. So when we are in a docking situation, they would not be allowed on the car deck until we are at the face of the dock.
Just one follow-up comment. I guess I just wanted to say that as a frequent user of the ferry system all my life, I think that the crews have done an excellent job in you know, preparing for safety of the passengers and upon arrival. So I guess perhaps the commissioner should follow up on that. Mm-hmm. You know, and make a commendation where it's necessary.
Senator Jones.
Do you know any pilots in inside water southeast, or do you have to have them?
We have our own.
We have our own.
That's what I mean.
Yes.
So you don't have to go up to the Pilot Association, or anything?
No.
Yeah. I thought you gave the impression that okay. these people, that you might be doing that.
And then I have any marine pilots that are licensed by the state.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, yes, we have our own pilots. In the case of us going into waters where they have not received pilotage, for example, the major refurbishment at Swan Island requires a specific non-state, non-marine highway pilot. But in the course of traversing our waters, we have our own pilots who have pilotage certified by the Coast Guard.
The Marine Pilots Board is up for sunsetting. The Pilots Association has done a lot of work in response to the OSCO Commission recommendations. And I was just figuring out whether you all are going to be around the table, too. So it sounds like you will be. Because you employ pilots. So you don't care what happens to
them. I would want to talk with our port captain and a couple of our pilots before I say that we are going to get involved in that.
Okay, we'll shift gears and go back to Representative Phillips. You had a policy question with
Jim, does your system plan explore the economic feasibility of an alternative type of ferry system, fast ferry, alternative type of ships to replace in the replacement scheme?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, we discussed that briefly in the paper. As Representative Hudson and I have discussed in the past, there's a great deal to be learned yet, I believe, about the question of fast ferries, of the different alternatives. We have our naval architect. We now have a certified, licensed naval architect on board, and that person is doing a white paper on the comparison of cost, service, efficiency of a displacement vessel versus what is now known as a fast ferry. We are not aware of any fast ferries operating in the United States. There are shipyards, and certainly there are naval architects that are building fast ferries, but not in this country that we know of right now. There are certainly shipyards that tell us that they're capable of building those, and there are certainly those who would like to see those built. We could get into that deeper if you want.
Representative Hudson, just follow up. There'll be a gentleman in here in a couple, 3 weeks, Jim, with Textron. As you know, they've proposed to offer us a prototype, and they've gone so far as to offer some general specifications of what they believe they can build. There is, I think, a Coast Guard commander here who was responsible for much of the construction of the Coast Guard surface effect vessels through that corporation. I'm not pushing Textron. It's just one that happens to be an American contractor that can build these things, as the old Bell helicopter outfit. You know. So maybe when they come in, our committees could also listen to, you know, what their state of the art is and what their engineers are telling them, as well as yourselves. And we'll invite you, make certain that you're invited when they're in town.
We appreciate
the
opportunity.
There now. Was there a comment that
this happened in your district, Senator? But you know, we have quite a problem with getting children in the Chase and above area to school. And the question was to run some kind of a rail bus, which we tried to locate, and the FRA would not permit any normal vehicle to carry children on a rail. So Textron came in with this brilliant idea of running a school bus as a boat up to the Susitna River. And their engineers were very convincing in saying how well that boat would manipulate all of the rocks and the ice and every other problem in carrying kids back and forth to school. And, well, I guess we just couldn't buy that. But we haven't solved the problem yet, but I'm not sure Textron is the one to do it.
I have one further question, Representative Hudson.
I'd be anxious to see the Coast Guard report on this. Was the anchor detail set when the ship was backing into the slip? You know?
Say again.
Was the anchor detail set?
Not that I know of.
Senator Pierce.
I have a general question. Are we happy with Bellingham?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, I personally had done a couple of research projects looking at the system prior to coming into the system when we were in Seattle. And It is far and away more than I think what we normally expect when we get into a competitive situation. Bellingham has a terminal that's two or three times better in terms of space, passenger accommodations, and sales are up, I guess is the bottom line. Yes, I'm very happy with Bellingham, but let me also say on the record, in case their representative is here, that they are coming to town because it is time to negotiate a new lease. And certainly one of the advantages to Bellingham was a very advantageous lease. And so they now have a lease opener, and we will be negotiating that lease in the next 30 days. So I guess I'll be able to tell you. They were outstanding this past year, both in marketing and assisting us, since we don't have marketing funds in the budget. They also were outstanding this past weekend. When I got there were many people who'd already been up 15 to 24 hours, and they were working around the clock. The city turned out. They had detailed a police crew that was around the clock in the terminal working with us, and they held their emergency crews at our dock. And so the community is very responsive, much, much more personal attention to us than we were receiving in Seattle.
Senator Jones.
Excuse me. Follow up on that marketing. Do you know what the extent of marketing is that they do, what Bellingham does for the ferry system?
No, but I'm sure we're going to hear about it this next week. Commissioner, you were going to say something?
Well, I think in all fairness, we should say that the passengers aren't as happy with the location. They would much rather be unloaded and loaded in Seattle than to have to get to Bellingham.
Really?
So outside of that, well, everything is working extremely well.
Do we get a lot of complaints?
I don't know that we get complaints that complain to the crew more than anything else. Jim, you can elaborate on that more than you probably have gotten some complaints. I have not. They're used to it now, and they'd prefer Seattle.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, we receive very few complaints now about Bellingham. It's so much better than what how people were treated in the past and what accommodations are made that I don't think I've received. There were a few at first, as I understand it, and there certainly are there are commercial complaints occasionally, but the general, I don't think I received five letters in the last 6 months complaining about Bellingham. Travel, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, one thing you should be aware of, and there are several passengers that travel from the Bellingham terminal to either SeaTac or downtown Seattle was a complaint for a while, but it was related to the Gray Line labor problem. And I think we have that now taken care of.
Jim, I'd just like to say that I know we have a maintenance condition with the ferry system, and we'll look at the condition surveys that will be coming out. We'll have to look at the dollar side and how that comes together. Is there in this or any other area, are you looking at any expansion of services, or are we trying to hold our own in the process, or are we looking at expanding up into the Cook Inlet area or anything else, or have do we have a focus on that yet?
No. No focus yet. You've probably been listening to the governor. we
well, there's a few of his ideas I like, and there's a few other ones that, you know.
I'm afraid that budget restrictions being what they are, it's going to be difficult to expand services. We're certainly trying to work out some arrangements that are not that expensive to do. Jim did some very good things over the Christmas season for, I guess, to Craig, or the Prince of Wales run. And things like that we will try to do to accommodate people. But as far as extending the service into areas not now served, that right now is not in the cards.
There was one other comment that I did get from a constituent that was living in the Big Lake area that had traveled a couple of years ago, and I don't know if they had been upgraded, but they said the site, the location site in Prince Rupert, where the access in the building, where they had to go get the tickets or something like that, was less than desired. I don't know. They mentioned some old trailer down around some area, and I hadn't been there in years and stuff. Is there any?
That's true.
Is there?
Mr. Chairman, that's accurate. It is.
Still is.
It is the case that is an unacceptable situation. I've recently talked with the community and their Transport Canada, their federal people. It is owned by a subsidiary of Transport Canada. We're trying to get that to become a subsidiary of the port, and we have told them that we expect them to fix that and to do something similar to Bellingham. We're in some very difficult negotiations with them right now. What we have said is that unless they're willing to accept that we're not able to sign a lease, and they, of course, now want us to sign a lease. We have a lease with them now that's fairly expensive, including us performing maintenance and repairs. What we need is a terminal there, and what we're asking them to do is to provide us with a terminal. So I guess it's slowly becoming it's quickly going to become a hardball game. And I've met with them twice now, and in the last setting, I told them it was no longer tolerable, and we told Transport Canada. The port people are now talking about the Port Development Corporation, which is a Crown corporation, constructing it and then doing a lease back through the community to us.
Well, it made such an impression on him that he took a photograph of it and brought it to me personally. So, and it was a reflection, because they don't understand. They think the state of Alaska is operating that, and that's a reflection on the state and everything else. So I would urge you on your negotiations to, if we can upgrade that would be good.
I understand.
Representative Mackey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question in regards to Prince Rupert. I've used that terminal, and I agree with that analogy that's correct. My question is Prince Rupert a... Now that we've had good success with the Bellingham run, per se, is Prince Rupert worth it to continue that operation and make a significant investment in Prince Rupert? Is the traffic levels such that it makes it a necessary link for the system, or has there been any an analysis done of what we can either add to the system or do without in the system?
We're going to quickly get into that discussion this year. I hope we get to the open kind of blood and guts decision. There's some major decisions that have to be made about what we're going to do with refurbishing and operating these ships. If we don't make them, it is clearly my opinion that it is time to make a major decision about downgrading specifically the Malaspina. If we are not going to make a commitment to get these ships refurbished, it is probably time to operate it. It's probably time to make the decision to eliminate a vessel, and that's the course we're on. Prince Rupert is serviced primarily by the Malaspina. That is her major port. The ships are all booked solid between, as many of you know, between May 1st and October 1st. And Prince Rupert, out of Prince Rupert, a ship can make almost twice the run as a ship out of Bellingham. Prince Rupert is an important port for us. Now, if we got into a hardball situation, and I've said this to Prince Rupert, we could live without Prince Rupert. We could do it differently. We could run a different. We could run more to Bellingham or different to Bellingham, and we could begin to develop a different port. But that's an expensive. I knew where we were headed there, Senator. I saw you beginning to grin. But that's an expensive alternative. Right? But so is dealing with Prince Rupert if they try and force us to be the ones to build a new terminal. I mean, I think that, and that's what I've said to them, if we're going to build a new terminal, and it's six of one, half dozen of another, and we're going to get ourselves into a financial situation, first order of business is get the ships operating. Second order of business then is decide where to invest the money in the ports.
Okay. A couple more questions, and then we'll hang it up. Representative Hudson.
Just a quick one. Jim, do we offer Canadian seniors the senior pass on our system in the off-shoulder? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Do we do that?
We afford any senior an equal opportunity as any other senior between Alaskan ports.
Would you contact BC Ferries and ask them if they would afford us
the same consideration
for sure. Our citizens sailing on their ships?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. I had a senior citizen ask me that. I think that's really a very important thing. I might have got to say it.
Final question.
You didn't need it. He was asking for himself.
Yeah, I think he needed it.
No more questions. I guess we'll. I do want to make an announcement for the Senate Transportation meeting on Thursday. I have a conflict with budget things, so instead of meeting at 1:30, we will meet at 2:30. We do have two bills on the agenda: the naming of the Bob Blodgett Gnome Teller Highway and a supplemental appropriation for DOT reinstatement of the vetoes on Class 3 roads maintenance and stuff. That will be at 2:30 on February 7th. With that, thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.